This is On the Other Hand.
Podcast that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community members who are working with others across the political divide. On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas, part of a national organization that aims to reduce political polarization by promoting honest and respectful dialogue among people of all political beliefs.
Hello and welcome to On the Other Hand. I'm your host, April Chatham Carpenter, and I'm here today with my co-host, Glenn White. Get ready for today's conversation, which will just be Glenn and me, as we compare our thoughts about some research and theories concerning political polarization. Hopefully you've had a chance to listen to some of the other episodes where Glenn had the extended discussion with retired psychologist Dr. Jerry Henderson, and they reviewed some key research data and theories concerning political polarization and related topics. And I know when Glenn and I were talking about this particular session, we were actually looking at some specific parts that we didn't include or that Glenn didn't include in that those different portions, and they were portions that were a little bit problematic for me that I asked him to hold out that we could actually potentially talk about. So we're going to start each one of these with an excerpt from their discussions, our conversation, and then we'll each share reactions or questions that we may have about that content. So in a way, this will be the first of what we expect to continue to do from time to time in our podcast, exploring issues from both a red and a blue perspective.
Yeah, that's right, April. And I appreciate the opportunity to do this. I think this is going to be great for us to show people how in Braver Angels we try to use certain communication skills to have respectful and productive dialogue while respecting our individual differences. As always, when you and I carry on our discussion, we'll be doing our best to follow that philosophy. We're going to be emphasizing careful listening, asking respectful questions to help better understand each other's views. We'll make sure that we avoid portraying our opinion or our interpretation of the situation as the absolute truth. And then what is really helpful where possible is to share some stories from our own personal experience, or maybe even talk about our personal values that help explain how we see things from a particular perspective. I look forward to this conversation. I'll tell our listeners up front, be ready to hear us find common ground at times. Also expect to hear us disagreeing sometimes, but with civility. So let's get started. Before we get to the excerpts, those of you who are not familiar with the Braver Angels skills, let's do a really quick review of the skills that we plan to use in our conversation. And these are skills, as I've said, that Braver Angels teaches for effective communication about political differences and other difficult conversations. With the goal of remaining respectful and encouraging genuine communication. So I will start with perhaps the most important, which is listening skills. One of the things that many of you have heard about is reflective listening or active listening. So that's going to be one of the keys. One way to do that is the use of paraphrasing. When you hear someone, make sure that you understand what they said by paraphrasing what you heard them say, and that helps that other person feel heard. And then the next thing after paraphrasing is when it comes time to understand better, if something you're not understanding or not sure about, ask them questions, but make them real and honest questions of understanding, not gotcha questions. We call them gotcha questions when you ask them a difficult question that has kind of a negative implication embedded in the question. So one way to ask this real honest questions of understanding would be simply to ask the person to help you better understand how they came to their view on an issue, particularly if they have a lot of emotion and strong feelings about it. Another thing is maybe stories. If we get them to tell us a story as to why they came to that view, that helps humanize them in our perspective. And then we also want to acknowledge the experiences behind the person's views, and hearing their stories helps with that. Another listening skill is to listen for the underlying values and aspirations that they have when they're talking about their views, and then acknowledge that by perhaps paraphrasing and pointing out that you heard that. So those are some of the key listening skills I suggest you listen for when you hear us talking today.
You might critique us as well, realizing that we're not going to do this perfectly as we move forward. But it's always good to be reminded of these key listening skills. There are also some speaking skills, and I have six here, that are things that we emphasize in our Braver Angels workshops in terms of how to best get your point across also as you're listening to the other person. And one of them is to use I statements rather than they believe something and pointing at the other side. Using I statements, this is how I see it, more often than truth statements such as this is how it is. Second speaking skill is to say something like, I'm concerned, or I'm worried, or I'm troubled. And that's a little bit better than talking about definitive, you know, this is what's going to happen in the future if we're not going to, you know, take care of this issue. And so that I'm concerned, troubled, and worried is that I statement's connected with more of a little bit less certainty in terms of the way you're communicating. A third speaking skill is to, if you see an area of similarity or agreement, try to mention that, oh yeah, I agree with that, or that seems like that's something we have in common. Fourth, before you express disagreement, it's really helpful, like Glenn was saying, to say some version of I hear you, which would be acknowledging what they're saying. So, you know, when they're saying this, well, you know, I hear that you're saying this, and trying to aim for, yes, I hear that, and I wonder about this, rather than, yes, I hear that, but this is a problem with what you're saying. Fifthly, if you feel strongly about an issue, saying something about what life experiences have led to you to be passionate about that, telling your own story. Glenn talked about listening to other people's stories, but telling your own stories, and stories do humanize issues. They make our passion about certain politics actually helps us come across as human beings who care. And then lastly, trying to soften flat out disagreements by signaling first that your perspective is very different, sometimes even asking for permission to share a different perspective. So those are just some things that we're going to try to practice. Again, we won't get it perfectly, and we're going to be talking about more science kinds of things. So it's a little bit different than having a conversation about a political topic like abortion or immigration, where there might be more actual policy differences. So Glenn, lead us into our first excerpt.
Yeah, we're going to listen first to a brief excerpt from Jerry and I. And at this point, we're going to be talking about the research on some brain differences that have been found between conservatives and liberals. And that may surprise some of you to know that that research is out there, but it's been done for a while. There's some significant stuff going on there. So we'll listen to that, and then April and I will take turns commenting on the content of that discussion. April, let's count on you starting first with your questions or thoughts after we hear the excerpt. Okay, let's go ahead and hear that excerpt on brain differences now.
So in terms of the neurobiological and structural differences in the brains of conservatives and liberals, and again, we're talking about research that differentiates them, not that one part of the brain is better than the other. So there is an MRI study. And it involved 90 young adults and shows that political conservatives, compared with political liberals, have actually greater gray matter in the right amygdala. And as we said before, the amygdala is pretty primary in processing fear cues and threat cues.
So if it's a larger right amygdala in conservatives, would that be consistent with the notion that they have more firepower to latch on to fearful stimuli in the environment? Is that
correct? I think that's the implication, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Also, a functional MRI study involving risk-taking shows that political conservatives have greater activity in the right amygdala on a different type of study. So the right amygdala is very well documented first, as it's the part of the brain that's most concerned with assessment of threat. And conservatives compared to liberals the brain lights up more and it's even bigger.
And in that last study you mentioned, so it's what was it that they were looking at that tended to arouse the threat response in conservatives?
Different types of just showing them things, a game of sorts, and you can take risk by trying to get more.
Okay, so it's about risk-taking. Okay. I'm now thinking about conversations with the financial advisor about, you know, are you conservative in your risk assessment about, you know, okay, but the same principle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
They're probably better investors than liberals.
Certainly more cautious would the argument would go based on, if you go based on this.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, I mean, this is not just one point in the brain. In what they call the inferior frontal gyrus, particularly on the right, is directly involved in risk aversion and lights up more in that area as well as the amygdala between conservatives and liberals. There's also research suggesting areas of the brain where liberals show less activity consistent with greater tendency for approach behavior relative to conservatives, and in my mind, that fits right with that. You're going to talk about some of the personality, the big five, that the approach for new experience.
That approach avoidance. You
know, yeah.
And avoidance is associated with the fight-flight response. You know,
sure.
Flee from it. Avoid it. Might be dangerous.
All right, Glenn, I remember what I reacted to inside when I was listening to this originally when you had sent me this part of the conversation that you had with Jerry. And I thought back, and I think about my own experiences and kind of my own journey through thinking and processing things in my own head, and how much I've changed over time. And if I had been in this study, if I had been one of those 90 young adults in that study, you know, I wonder where I, you know, what I would have been, you know, where my brain would have been lighting up as they were talking about. Because I didn't like risk as a conservative. I don't think I connected it to being conservative, though. I think I connected it to the way I was raised. And not about politics at all, more about the carefulness and cautiousness around finances that my parents put within me, you know, taught me about the cautiousness that was connected to some of my faith training as well. And so when I think about this, I think about this less as being conservative liberal and more about a personality trait. I really have I don't have a very high tolerance for uncertainty, but I think that's a personality trait more than it is related to whether I'm conservative or liberal. So that was one of my reactions. So I'll stop there and let you kind of hear, practice those skills, and then I have another thought also about this.
Okay, sure. So if I understand, kind of your main point is that you think maybe you're less convinced about there being brain differences in this area of sensitivity to threat, because you also are aware in your own life and your own upbringing you had influences that are not brain related. The way your parents raised you, the way you saw them model behavior as you were growing up, and also the, you know, the exposure to your religious background, is that kind of an important part of your point?
Yeah, and also that I think there are other personality kind of traits that come along with this. I guess part of my wondering about, and maybe this will kind of be a thread throughout several of my comments to these excerpts, is I don't like to label folks, to say that there's one cause to something happening in the brain. And so I'm sure the study was looking just at, you know, maybe multiple things, but looking at conservative versus liberal, there might be other causes besides the fact that these people are connected to a more conservative side of things or more liberal side of things that would be actually impacting why the brain's acting that way. The fact that you've got two groups that are like that, but what else is going on for those those people? What other characteristics do they have? Are there nuances besides the fact that they are just conservative or liberal? And those are things that I would want to find out.
Yeah, and actually, I'm totally in agreement with you. So it's important to understand that when this study was done, it was looking specifically only at brain differences. It's not meant to say that brain differences account for everything. Goodness knows I do not believe that at all. I'm a strong believer in a combination of nature nurture. You know, the idea that, yeah, we are born with, we inherit from our parents certain biological, physiological, and brain characteristics, but then those have lifelong impacts, so do the things that we learn and the experiences we have. So I totally in agreement with you on that, and so I don't want anyone to get the wrong idea that we're saying everything is determined by the brain. But it is one important influence. In this research, they're implicating some specific areas where this part of the brain has an impact. Another point I would make is that the parents we have share some of our genetic makeup. So that's also something talked about in the research when people are looking at nature versus nurture. Sometimes it's hard to know how much of it is due to we share similar brain or physiological characteristics versus, you know, the experience. But clearly both have an impact. In fact, over the years, I've been very interested in that nature-nurture issue. And I'm, as a psychologist, you might imagine, I'm a strong believer in the importance of nurture. Of our experiences, and not just that we're destined from the start of birth onward by just the way the brain and the way we were born. So that's really important. There's another point here that I wanted to make. You mentioned personality, and I forgot to mention that. Well, personality also is felt to be in the research in this area to be brain-based as well. That, in other words, people are born with tendencies, they call them temperaments, towards certain kinds of personalities. But as with everything else, you may be born with that temperament, but that's not the only thing that influences you. Over the course of your life, your experiences, education, and personal choices, you know, have an impact on that and shape the total person that you are. So, and then one final point that I think is important to make is that when we're talking about this research, it may sound as if we're starting with the notion of conservative liberal. Well, they were trying in this research to figure out some of the differences that influence being conservative liberal. But the primary thing here is the brain and what the brain influences are. So I would suggest that when you hear this, think in terms first of people having differences in the brains they were born with. Now, this makes sense if you think about it. We all have differences. Some people have a tendency to have a high temper. Other are very calm natured. Some people have a tendency toward addiction. Other people have a tendency toward depression. Some people have a bright extroverted personality. Others tend to be introverted. So all of those are brain-based, but they are influenced by experiences. And what I'd say is that what I see happening with this research is that we figured out there are some brain differences in people. And so for people whose brains are more oriented to notice and respond to threat in the environment because of the greater volume of the right amygdala brain tissue, that then may be one of the factors that tends to lead them toward development in later life of a conservative belief system. Not that they were born conservatives, they were born with a certain type of brain, and that has an impact along with other things. Does that all of that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because as you've been talking about this, and even as I was kind of pushing back a little bit at the beginning in my comments, for some reason I was thinking that conservative, if we were going to look at, you know, in terms of science and like what's causing what, I wasn't thinking of the brain being what's causing. I was thinking of this as not being brain matter and what we're kind of born with. I was thinking of it more as how we react to stimuli, and actually because of the inputs that we might be taking in as conservatives or liberals, that actually would lead us to react in a certain way. So, you know, and I think that you've made a good distinction between it certainly is nature versus nurture. But even now, I mean, when I take in, I'll just pick COVID as an example. You know, I remember at the very beginning when I was, you know, depending on what news sources I was listening to, there was either a lot of fear or not fear. And so if I would choose to go towards those, the more fearful kind of, these are really awful things happening and negative things happening during COVID, then I'm going to be, you know, more risk averse, right? So I'm taking that in, and I never think about it as I'm doing that because my brain already is likely to be leading me in that direction. I think of it as there's so much coming in and I can make choices. But then I'm not a psychologist, so I don't think of it in probably the same way as you're thinking about it. And actually, I just read an interesting op-ed I'm blocking on where I saw it, but this guy, it has a book coming out in 2023, and it's talking about basically about why we are getting it wrong when we're labeling people as right or left, and how, besides the fact that has changed over time in terms of what it means, but he uses the idea of risk by itself to talk about that an example of more risk-taking behavior actually happened during COVID, with not choosing to get a vaccine, not necessarily having masks or wanting to be against masks, on more of the more conservative side of things. I mean, I'm conservative, and I got a vaccination and I wore masks, so it's not that all of us did the same thing. But more of the risk-averse behavior, actually, less risk-taking happened on the side of the more, what we would consider more liberals. And I think that's interesting. And he was making that point that even the science research, which says that tendencies towards risk-taking, more willingness for that in the conservative behavior would be less risk-taking, that didn't play out in the COVID crisis, which I think was interesting. So says something about the science. It's not a perfect science for sure.
Well, the science is never perfect. Our understanding maybe is never perfect. Science is just meant to gradually chip away at knowledge and get a better understanding of what's going on. We're always going to be ignorant on a number of levels, I would say.
It did make me question the science, though. It made me question that the risk taking, that the idea that conservatives are less averse to take risk, because they were actually in many cases during COVID more likely to take risk than the liberals. And again, we're grouping people together in ways that, you know, not everybody was that way.
So that's a good point. So from the way he's talking about it, then at least with the COVID crisis, conservatives as a group seem to be less risk averse than liberals. And I think you're right. That's the way it turned out there. My thought on that would be that what probably explains both of those is how much we've gotten polarized in this society, and that decisions that in the past may have been based strictly more on our assessment of the risk are increasingly made on the basis of what our party endorses. We're seeing more of that now. And that, to me, just simply points out the incredible power of tribalism and the brain-based, I would suggest, tendencies to go along with your tribe and your group. And in that case, I'd say there's a good case to be made that it happens on both sides, that we pick whatever our leaders in our tribe say, and then we hold fast to that, and it overcomes some of those innate tendencies. That would be my thinking.
Probably leads us into some of these other excerpts. So should we go on to the next one?
Sure, let's do that.
All right. Well, this one, you and Jerry were talking about cognitive and physiological differences between liberals and conservatives. So we'll also take turns commenting on the content of that discussion. And, all right, let's listen to this one.
So here's some cognitive and physiological studies. The negativity bias is evident in studies that show negative images shown to political conservatives compared to political liberals result in a greater, faster, and longer attention focus on images with greater physiological measures of harm. And there's a greater tendency to avoid them. And this negativity bias is very consistent with what we were talking about. Conservatives are, with that right amygdala, are more focused in on threat assessment.
Now, you just threw out the right amygdala.
We're getting ready to talk about that.
Oh, okay. But it's basically a brain.
Yeah, it's a part of the brain that's associated with processing information about potential threat.
Okay.
And additionally, physiologically, conservatives compared with liberals tend to have increased skin conductance responses when they see aversive or negative images. On eye tracking of negative images, conservatives compared with liberals are faster to fixate on them and spend more time gazing at them.
So what I think you're doing to kind of summarize that in a simple way is that there are various physiological measures that have been shown experimentally to differentiate liberals from conservatives simply by exposing them to scary or gross or fear-inducing images.
Yeah.
As a group, conservatives seeing the same things that liberals do tend to have a greater, quicker arousal of fear and pay more attention to it.
Yeah.
So maybe this is why I don't like horror movies. seriously, I don't, because they give me nightmares. But then I don't know how much, you know, I have no idea what my eye tracking does. This is interesting research to take a look at. And, you know, thinking about focused on threat assessment. The right amygdala, I've heard some people refer to it as our lizard brain. And I had forgotten about this, but was thinking about this because I use the lizard brain when I talk about conflict and how oftentimes we have these knee-jerk reactions to things that we just automatically immediately react, and we have to slow things down and to get different perspectives. And conflict management, I talk about, you know, taking a balcony view. You know, if somebody's up in your face and they're yelling at you, and I mean, your immediate reaction is to defend yourself, to flee, or to fight, or to freeze. And that's what I see. This is what reminded me of is, like, you know, which things are being called on in my emotional makeup, and the brain connecting so much into that. I think I have less problems with this part and listening to it again now than I did when I initially thought. I think initially when I heard the word negativity bias, I was like, so what? What are the researchers saying that conservatives are just more negative? That's not what I heard this time, but that's what I think I initially reacted to. And then the idea of that I'm just going to keep focusing on those negative things. And I'm like, well, I always like to think of myself as a positive communicator and to not be focusing on those negative things. I know, though, as a human being, I think all of us do this, regardless of conservative or liberal, is that we can have a tendency to be focusing on the negative input. I mean, when I get my teacher evaluations at the end of the semester, if there's 24 really good comments and one really bad comment, it's the one bad comment that I will fixate on. You know, and I've talked to other people and I've never thought about it being conservative or liberal thing. I think it's a human nature sometimes thing. So I don't know. I don't have as much reaction to this as I thought I was going to. Glenn, what are your thoughts?
Well, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. First off, you responded to the word negativity, and that reminds me of something I just saw the other day that's pointing out, it's talking about science education and how it's important for scientists who are trying to get message out to the public to appreciate the difference in meaning of the language that science uses sometimes that's taken in a different way by the lay public. And so this would be a perfect example. You hear negativity bias, and it may sound to the lay person like you're accusing people with a greater negativity bias of being more cynical or negative, you know, when in fact it's simply saying that people with a greater negativity bias are more prone to immediately look at and respond to negative, like threatening, scary, whatever stimuli in their environment. And that's all it means. It's not a value judgment of any type. But you said another thing I agreed with, which is that this arousal, we're talking in a way about arousing the fight-flight response, the lizard brain. Yeah, that's what all of this is related to, these brain differences, the physiological differences are arising in areas of the brain that control the fight-flight response. And the fight-flight response is there for a very good reason. It has helped us survive to this day by fighting or fleeing from real danger. Problem nowadays, of course, is that most of the dangers or danger signals, let's say, that we face in our environment are not life-threatening. They are maybe ego-threatening or things like that, but our brain has not evolved enough. It's still reacting as if our life is in danger. So that's you know, part of what I'm thinking there. There was one thing that you said earlier that I wanted to mention. I think you said something along the lines of that people will respond to stimuli differently as individuals and depending upon what the situation is that they encounter, and which of course is true. I just wanted to point out that in the research that we're talking about here, both groups, you know, responded to the same stimuli. So there's no difference from the situation they're presented with by that. So that cannot account for any differences as a group. And then the other part about that, I think, that comes up later, I believe, is simply that just because there is an overall group difference between liberals and conservatives in some areas doesn't mean that every individual is going to be that way. You can find many exceptions of people who are conservative that may not have this tendency, as you could do the same thing with liberals. It's just that if you get a group of equal number of liberals and conservatives in a room who don't have any major differences in other things like education or that kind of thing, then as a group, they will differ in some areas that this research is looking at. When you add them up and get the average, you know, the mean score, but there will always be outliers in each group.
Well, I love that you brought that up because that's been one of my concerns about this kind of research, is that I don't want people to walk away as they're listening to us think about that this is always true of all conservatives, or this is always true of all liberals, because it's never always true. Anytime we have just one label that we're putting people into, we're missing the opportunity of seeing the beautifulness of their humanity that's so beyond just that one label. And it gets us to where we can stereotype people. But I think people can take this kind of research and actually do that of the other side. And so that was one of the reasons why I wanted to get on this call and actually talk about that, because just because the research may say something doesn't mean that we can say, well, now that's why those people are like that. Because then that's saying to myself, what I've just done is I have cut out a whole piece of humanity that I'm not probably willing to communicate with when I call them those people. I mean, that's the polarization that you were talking about. So thank you for bringing that up, Glenn. That's good.
Sure. Yeah, in fact, this relates to something you mentioned before that occurred to me too, which is that these research studies we're talking about are looking at very immediate responses physiologically and in terms of brain activity. Keep in mind that just because there are immediate differences, in the initial response to a threat signal, let's say, that does not mean that dictates every behavior after that, because as you pointed out before, you have the capacity to think after you've been exposed to that stimuli and you have that initial frightening response to the horror movie, for instance, to then think it through and say, okay, I'm not really in danger here, and you can tamp down your initial physiological reaction. So that's, to me, a very important point, is that these are talking about tendencies and potentials. They have an impact on behavior, but they do not guarantee outcome. A lot of that winds up being related to the choices that we make and the values that we have. And that's why we do what we do in Braver Angels, is because we know that even though there are strong things pushing us apart, we have the capacity to do something about that and move in a much better direction if we use the better parts of ourselves.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about as you were talking about that just now, Glenn, is the concept of resilience. And how resilience, and however you know, usually is defined as the ability to face something that's difficult. And to build resilience, it's like building a muscle. And there's conflict resilience also. So we may not be, you know, we may be like wanting that approach behavior towards the other, but the more we do it, the more we find the humanness of the other, the more we're able to actually practice these things. And I found this in my own experience in Braver Angels. I mean, when I first started in the organization and you introduced it to me in 2019, I wasn't interested in talking to anybody about politics. Politics was like, no, that is not something I want to talk about because I don't like conflict. But I've gotten to the place where I'm building up skill sets that, of course, I use and tell my students to use, but I'm building up the skill sets and the grit and the resilience and the willingness to actually do this. So now I'm starting to feel like I can face maybe some of those fears or some of the difficulties in that I don't want to face when I'm having those kind of conversations. So the more we practice actually coming towards something that we might initially see as negative, I think also helps us be able to better assess the threat the next time.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And, you know, I'll tell you, too, another little point I will make to people who are interested in trying out doing what you're saying and kind of building up their skills and their resilience and find that it gets better. This is not the kind of thing that gets better automatically and continues to get better with no downslides. It is a difficult task that we're proposing people do, and there will always be times when most of us, maybe all of us, backslide and get into that emotional tribal thing again. In fact, I had that experience this past week with someone I'm close to that, you know, I preach all these things that we do, and then we had this moment and there was a trigger that person said, it was a trigger for me, and I found myself violating all the things that I'm telling people to do in Braver Angels. Luckily, I quickly realized what happened. It did a little momentary damage, but then I quickly saw what was happening. I stopped. I backed off. I acknowledged that I wasn't, you know, behaving the way I should. I apologized. I didn't change my opinion that, you know, led to that, but I wasn't doing the right thing. And to me, that's just a good example of how we all have a long journey ahead of us, and it's not always on the up. It has its down points that we have to power through.
But my guess is, Glenn, that a few years ago, I'm only guessing, and you don't have to answer this with a yes or no here, but my guess is a few years ago, you wouldn't have stopped. You wouldn't have apologized, potentially. Now, if it was a good friend, you might have. And that's what I see myself as I'm growing and learning. And it's easy to put ourselves down and when we get into those situations. I mean, I had a situation that wasn't politics, but it was related to my young adult daughter this week. And texting messages and phone messages, you know, a phone call going that I had just talked in my classes about the need to slow things down, the need to take deep breaths, the need to, you know, really listen to the other person and where they're coming from. And I just lost it in this conversation. I realized it as I was losing it. And then I'm like, okay, I finally left my phone with my husband and said, would you finish this conversation with her? I walked away. About 2 hours later, I was clear-headed. I was able to apologize. And, you know, I think I could handle the conversation much better now if it came to me. But the trigger, you know, that's what triggers our lizard brain. I'm going to call that amygdala, that right amygdala, our lizard brain. Thanks to our listeners for joining us for this edition of On the Other Hand. We hope you enjoyed the first part of my discussion today with Glenn about the science surrounding brain differences. Be sure to check out the upcoming parts of our conversation as well and other podcast episodes of On the Other Hand on the Braver Angels Arkansas website at arkansas.braveranGels.org/podcast.
Yeah, and April, we'd love to hear, as always, from our listeners. If you have any feedback about what you like about our program or how we can do better, and especially if you have ideas for speakers or topics, we'd love to hear from you. So just email us at otherhandar@gmail.com. That email link, by the way, is on our podcast page. So if you go to our Braver Angels Arkansas website, you can see it there.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, Glenn White.
And April Chatham Carpenter.
Have a good evening. Let's all work to bring our community closer together, shall we?